The third case for oral argument this morning is Holscher versus Valley Queen Cheese Factory. The appellant Holscher is represented by Mark Freeman, an attorney from Minneapolis. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you are a member of the South Dakota Bar?
Yes, ma'am.
Very well. And for the appellee, Valley Queen Cheese Factory is Ms. Susan Brunick Simmons from Sioux Falls, correct? Mr. Freeman, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Mark Freeman, and I'm here today representing the appellant Chris Holscher in his claim for recovering workers' compensation benefits for an injury he sustained on October 1st, 2003 while employed at Valley Queen Cheese Factory. The basic facts of this case are not really in dispute. On October 1st, 2003, Mr. Holscher violated a rule that Valley Queen had imposed against propping open a spring-loaded valve. This valve was used to dispense acid into a barrel. Mr. Holscher knew that there was a rule prohibiting this, and he came forward and admitted this to the employer when the incident occurred. This act resulted in the spill of chemicals. Another person from the factory did turn off the valve or remove the block, shutting off the flow of chemicals. But a pool of acid had gathered on the floor. This eventually was mixed with some chlorine and created a gas. Mr. Holscher went in to clean up the mess. He found a respirator. Did not use the respirator properly. It wasn't hooked up. And he went in to do the cleanup, inhaled the gas, and suffered injury. The issue of the case is whether Valley Queen should be allowed to avoid liability under the Workers' Compensation Act for these inhalation injuries under 62437. The workers' compensation system is a remedial system. It's also intended to be given liberal construction in order to provide benefits to people injured in the workplace. This exception under 62437 should be construed narrowly. It should only be in a rare occasion where an employer is allowed to avoid this liability. After all, the workers' compensation system is one that compensates a worker for an accident that occurred at work, whether it was the worker's fault or whether it was not. Many of the injuries that we see in workplaces were due to the fault of the injured worker, yet they're allowed to recover. In this case, the issue is whether or not the valve that was disarmed by Mr. Holscher was in fact a safety device as defined under 62437, and whether propping open that valve was a willful violation of that rule. The parties agree that the appropriate standard to look at is the standard that was espoused by the department, which is a four-part test given by Professor Larson, being number one, did a safety rule exist? And number two, if so, was there a willful refusal to obey that rule? Number three, was the injured worker given actual as opposed to constructive knowledge of the rule and the danger involved if the rule was violated? And finally, whether that rule was kept alive by continuous enforcement. How this standard is applied is where the parties differ, and that's what we're here to talk about today. The first question raises whether or not a safety rule existed. This is a case of first impression before this court. This court has reviewed the statute, but has never really looked at the definition of safety as used in that statute. Both briefs have brought in cases from other jurisdictions to look at for guidance. But none of these are binding on this court. It just gives us some idea of what other jurisdictions are doing with the definition of safety. Since the word safety is in our statute, we should give it some meaning. You can't just have not using any device or not following any rule be a bar to benefit. This court has spoken indirectly on that issue in Phillips, which is a horseplay case. Horseplay was a work rule. That employer did have a rule prohibiting horseplay. A horseplay rule certainly has a safety element, but the primary purpose of that rule is for productivity of the workers. You don't want your workers goofing off all day. But it's undeniable that there's a safety component or a safety aspect. In Phillips, the worker was entitled to recover. The employer was not allowed to use the bar to benefits. And indirectly, the court has agreed that violation of well, actually specifically stated that violation of any rule is not a bar to benefits and is not necessarily misconduct. Valley Queen is asking the court to adopt a standard that has been espoused by the Georgia courts in defining safety. And that court has stated that any device that reduces a danger or hazard in operation of machinery is a safety device. That court's definition also looks at the rules and says that any conscious or intentional rule violation as opposed to an indirect or inadvertent rule violation is willful misconduct. That is a very broad interpretation, a very broad rule, and actually goes against what this court has already stated in Phillips as a rule that South Dakota is going to follow. Not all work rules are safety rules, and it needs to be more specific and more of an element as part of the purpose behind the rule that the safety of the employee is at issue.
Well, Mr. Freeman, you know, do we even need to get to this primary safety issue? Because what could be more dangerous to employees in the workplace than acid spills in the workplace? And both the device and the rules here are designed to reduce acid spills.
That's true, that the rule and the device are designed to avoid an acid spill. But you also have to look at the record as a whole and see that acid spills are actually quite common in this environment.
Well, but again, my question, though, is what could be more dangerous to employees in the workplace than acid spills?
Well, I think that an open saw blade would be more dangerous to a worker who's working on a saw.
But you have to concede that acid spills are extremely dangerous to workers in the workplace.
I think that an acid spill is a dangerous thing that could cause a burn. And I think that if an acid spill occurred, I think that somebody might contemplate suffering an acid burn.
Is that what your client's asking for, compensation of the burn?
No.
Well,
no. The injury that resulted here is an inhalation of a gas that was formed when the acid mixed with...
An acid spill.
Right. But it was an acid that mixed with another chemical, and during the cleanup of that spill, using a respirator, the respirator wasn't working properly, which is what eventually caused the injury.
Did the acid itself have, I don't know much about acids, but as I understand it, most acids have fumes, whether they mix with other acids or other chemicals or not. Did this particular acid have fumes too?
You know, there was no record as to whether there was an odor or fumes. The acid itself, when inhaled, was not toxic. I don't think you'd want to drink it, get it too close to your face, but just being around the acid, the container, and I know counsel brought some pictures, and I don't remember how good of a picture we get, but the acid is actually going from the valve into a semi-open container. So if, you know, to the extent that fumes are coming from the acid, they're there whether it's been spilled or not.
What is the evidence then on this spring, whatever the latch was, to keep the opening? What was the purpose of that? For what reason was that on there?
Well, the record, when you look at it, states that the purpose of this valve was to avoid a chemical spill. And the spill as defined by this employer was the spill of the chemical into the city sewer. The thing that we have pointed out in this regard.
So that's the distinction then of why it wasn't a safety device?
Correct.
Because it was to prevent the spill as opposed to preventing injuries.
Correct. It was.
Is that a finding of fact then that we can defer to the fact finder?
I don't think that was a finding of fact, but when looking at the record, the evidence that was offered by the employer showed that the spill was, or that the valve was in order to avoid a spill into the city sewer system. And all of the testimony of the witnesses were the same. The only testimony indicating that this valve had a safety purpose was testimony that, yes, there was also a safety component, but the answers given by all those who were questioned on the purpose of this valve mentioned the primacy of this city sewer problem and to avoid waste.
I thought the valve came way before the drain plug, which was designed to prevent leakage into the city sewer system.
It did.
So I don't follow them.
Okay, if we look at Exhibit 29, which is a memo from June of 2002, which is before the plug, it's a memo sent out to all employees from Valley Queen, and it's entitled, the subject is chemical spills. And in this memo, the company is telling the employees, we've had way too many chemical spills, and this is violating our pre-treatment permit with the city of Milbank. And so we've got concerns over our permit. We're in violation of our permit, so we have to keep tighter controls on these spills. Now, in this memorandum that was sent out to all employees, this is the memo that says now that the only people who are going to be dispensing the chemical are supervisors.
Can I interrupt you, though? I'm looking at the findings of fact here, and the let's see, where these are findings of fact by the department, I suppose, the corrected findings of fact that are attached to your brief. And it says that the claimant understood the valve operated, and then that it is a safety device as a finding of fact. And then again over here that there's a finding of fact that these were safety rules. So following your argument here, before you get too far into it, are you saying then that these findings of facts are clearly erroneous?
I'm saying that the findings of facts are an interpretation of the law. Our law hasn't been defined as to what is a safety device, what is a safety rule, and the findings of fact have not given us any insight into whether or not the judge considered the appropriate standard or even what the standard is that the judge considered.
Why isn't that a finding of fact given a situation? I mean, that in some cases that same valve, following through, might be considered, depending upon how it's used, a safety device, where in some cases it may not. And here it's just to prevent a spill, as you're arguing. So doesn't the finder of fact have to listen to everything and figure out? I mean, you can't just look at it and say, oh, that's a safety device. It has to be whatever the employer is using it for. And wouldn't that then depend upon the facts that were presented to the fact finder?
I think it is a mixed question of fact and law.
Okay.
But unfortunately, the findings of fact don't give us enough guidance or enough insight into what the judge was doing with the law to know how he arrived at that finding of fact.
Well, was that, were there proposed objections or anything like that that would have offered that to the fact finder at the time?
At the time of the written, what happened following the hearing is there was a ruling from the bench. Counsel prepared a proposed order for the judge to sign with findings of facts, and an objection was made, but the judge signed the findings as proposed.
And in your objection, did you propose a particular definition that should have been used by the finder of fact?
I didn't propose a definition, but I did point out the flaws in simply coming to the conclusion that there was a safety device without going to the analysis of how you arrived at the safety device, not just coming to, which I pointed out to the judge, that being a legal conclusion.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted you. You were on a thought there.
Yeah, I was on a couple of them, and I'll see if I can come back to it. Exhibit 29, when you read through it, doesn't anywhere in here mention safety of the employee. It talks about the purpose of the valve, but it doesn't talk about safety of the employee, nor does it indicate anywhere in here, and by the way, if you don't do this right, you're going to get hurt, or you could get hurt. Counsel is going to show you pictures of signs that said, you know, don't lock open the valve. The sign doesn't say, or you might get hurt. It doesn't say, warning, danger. The sign just says, don't lock open the valve. And we acknowledge that there was a sign that said, don't lock open the valve, and that there's a rule that says, don't lock open the valve. But the issue here is, in what priority was this safety element? And that is a legal standard and a legal conclusion that the judge has to apply. And it's our argument that the judge didn't go through the proper analysis in determining whether or not the device was a safety device. As we went through in our brief, there's different standards that have been given, but what we need to look at is, what was the employer's purpose in installing this valve? Was the employee's safety the primary purpose? Was it even a thought, or was it an afterthought that, oh, by the way, that might also help out in avoiding a burn, or even if they said it might avoid a chemical inhalation.
Well, they fired that one employee for misusing the valve. What significance is that?
Well, that shows that they kept the... Pardon me?
And your client knew about it.
My client knew about that termination, and I think that goes to the fourth element, whether or not this rule was enforced, not whether or not it was a safety rule. That goes to
why would he have been fired for propping it open if it wasn't a safety rule?
Because it put in jeopardy their permit with the city sewer system, which they were in violation of after that spill.
But the drain was plugged.
No, it wasn't. Plug didn't come in until 2003. So the first spill after the plug was installed was Mr. Holscher's spill with his injury in October 2003. The prior spills caused an overflow that went down the drain.
Does it weaken your case, the fact that they put the plug in and still kept the valve?
I think that it goes to the foreseeability element of whether or not this type of injury was foreseen. And the employer is talking about their safety policies and that they have a lot of concern about safety, and I don't doubt that. I don't think that this employer foresaw this injury, which is why they installed the plug. Because according to all of their policies and all of their arguments and their written documents, we don't have any hazards that would cause a known injury. That drain of the plug actually was such a hazard if this type of injury could have been foreseen, but it wasn't foreseen by either the injured worker or this employer.
Do you have any key arguments on steps 2, 3, and 4 of Larson's test?
You've
only got a minute.
Yeah, I've only got a little over a minute, and I'll just briefly go over the 2 and 3 are more on a foreseeability type analysis, and the fact that in order to be a willful act, the employee had to foresee the type of injury that he was engaging in or had to foresee that the type of activity he was engaging in was going to result in the type of injury that was eventually sustained. And we've relied on Tranby, which is a guest statute case, in talking about the definition of willful. And in order to willfully violate that that rule or disengage that device, the specific result had to be foreseen. And the third element also is an element of foreseeability. I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to start a new argument. But essentially, the facts of the case in a whole should not allow this employer to take this case out of the work comp realm.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Ms. Simmons, you have 20 minutes.
Before you get started, does safety have to be a primary purpose?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I do not believe that safety has to be the primary purpose. I think many devices can have many purposes. As long as safety is a key element of that, I think that is what is necessary.
So and is that a mixed question of law or fact, or is that a finding of fact by the administrative law judge?
I would go back to what you said earlier, Justice Meyer-Henry, that being that depends upon the circumstances, and therefore the administrative law judge just have to sit and listen to why this was enacted in the first place, why they created this device, why they had it available, all of the facts of that particular case, and therefore it becomes a finding of fact subject to the clearly erroneous standard of review.
And did, are these, can you point to the finding of fact that actually the administrative law judge in this case actually did determine that the primary purpose was for safety?
I don't believe that he ever indicated that the primary purpose was for safety, because I don't believe that was ever asserted by either party that that was the law. We went by the four-part test that was pronounced by Nance and is consistent with Larson, and we reviewed that with the hearing officer. Again, this was a bench decision, which is a rarity in all instances.
Do we need to remand it for that issue, for them to, if we say that, you know, I mean, this is a severe remedy to totally disallow workers' comp in a no-fault situation.
It absolutely is, Your Honor.
And so if we are to come up with a black-letter definition now of, or what the court needs to, or the lower administrative law judge needs to look at, and what involves a safety device, would we be required in this case then to return it for that analysis?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe you could go back and look at the facts, and if those facts support that legal theory, then I think you can be affirmed on that basis. And I think it does. I think when you go back and you look at the evidence that was put in here, first of all, this manufacturing process is inherently dangerous. It requires the use of dangerous chemicals.
Wouldn't we be changing the rule then, and then making a decision based on a rule that the trial court wasn't using?
If you come to the conclusion that our law requires the primary purpose, then I think that may be correct, but I don't think that is the law in South Dakota. The only state that has adopted that is the state of Louisiana. It's the only case that appellant has been able to demonstrate and to show to this court, and I think it's interesting.
But isn't it true, when you read Larson, he says that most states don't even have this law in their books?
Oh, I disagree, Your Honor. I provided the evidence of Tennessee, Georgia, Virginia, Alabama.
About a third of the states, I think.
But the fact that other states don't have it doesn't mean we don't enforce it here in South Dakota, because we do have it.
I'm not saying that, but don't overstate that all the states rule one way, because a lot of states don't even consider they don't allow this opportunity for employer to escape liability.
Correct. And I would point out, Your Honor, that in the cases that have come before this court, when willful misconduct has been raised as a defense, often, as is the case here, it's a very tragic situation. In Thurkelson, the employee died. In Goble, the employee had a very severe cervical injury. In Driscoll, there was a terrible, terrible injury. So oftentimes this is raised when the facts come before you in a very difficult situation. But what the courts have said in those cases are, even though the purpose, and I'm quoting from Thurkelson and Fenner, is to transfer from the worker to the employer, and alternatively to the public, a greater portion of economic loss due to industrial accidents and injuries, it is not without limitations. Public policy to transfer from the worker to the employer and the public a greater portion of that economic loss does not embrace a claimant's willful misconduct, which is a bar to benefits. It is the law in South Dakota. Now, again, I would like to point out the Louisiana.
What's to prevent, you know, I mean, there's, you can't, you have all kinds of things that are safety, that the employer puts rules out that are, you know, for the safety of the employees. So now are we going to open a whole new door that absolutely everything now, if it's called a safety device, a device by the employer becomes a safety device and then eliminates the workers' comp?
Absolutely not.
Well, so then don't, aren't we obligated to come up with something that's a threshold determination of what or what isn't a safety device, which wasn't exactly, did not exactly happen here.
I would disagree there, Your Honor. I'm going to show you some exhibits that were...
But there wasn't a finding of such.
There was a finding that this was a safety device and this was a safety rule. And that finding was based upon all of the evidence. And it was based upon the fact, the exhibit that I'm, that the first exhibit is exhibit number 12 in the certified record at page 171. This is the room where the incident occurred. And over here where this barrel is with the blue lid, that's the barrel that was being filled. And over here are chemicals, other chemicals that are used in the process by that Saber system, which you read about in Greece. You will notice that what happens is here, a computer dispenses the chemical into this bucket. This bucket is placed under there according to the evidence to collect any residuals, all right? So this is a very small room. This employer has done everything possible to make it a safe workplace for employees because of the fact that these hazardous chemicals are used. Now, there is evidence in this record that there was considerable training given to the employees, and that can't be overlooked, on the nature of these chemicals. That is, that this chemical over here, which is an alkaline, is never to mix with this chemical over here, which is an acid, because it will form this hazardous gas. This wasn't a big secret. This was some significant training that Mr. Holscher admitted attending on more than one occasion, in fact, on three occasions in the record. Plus, there's evidence that material safety data sheets are kept within this room, right outside around this corner, so that if you're going in, you can find out about these dangerous chemicals. Then they create and they require that this valve be used. And this is a picture of the spring-loaded valve in its upright position. As per the evidence, the only way that this chemical can be dispensed is if you stand there and hold it. That is to prevent that hazardous chemical from spilling in this room that contains other hazardous chemicals that can cause mustard gas. Now, not only does it require you to stand there for purposes of filling, but the evidence is that people would come in and out of this room. They would come in and out of the Saber room to fill their buckets with these other chemicals. By this rule and by the use of the device that means you can't leave the room, you can observe what's happening in that room. You can observe if somebody came in to fill up their bucket with alkaline, which is the hazardous chemical. You can see if there was a spill.
When you push down that lever, does it hold by itself?
Oh, absolutely. That's no, it does not.
That's not.
Mm-hmm. Here's what happened. Excuse me, it's upside down. This is exactly what Mr. Holscher did on October 1st of 2003. He stood there, was in a hurry. He didn't want to have to stand there and fill that tank. So he picked up a cap and he inserted it in there in order to disengage that safety device right next to the sign that says, do not lock valve open.
That's still the issue. I don't think, you know, I don't think anybody's disputing what he did and that it was obviously against everything that was published and so forth. I still think we're coming back, though, to whether or not the information about whether that was a safety device for purposes of the statute was thoroughly explored by the administrative law judge.
Well,
and
I mean,
it may have been, and it may be, but was that fleshed out at that time? Because we have not ruled on that issue before.
Well, you have ruled on what is misconduct.
Right.
There's no doubt about that. That it is willful misconduct is more than mere negligence. It contemplates the intentional doing of something with knowledge it's likely to result in injury and with reckless disregard of the probable consequences.
But we've never dealt with the safety device issue in this kind of a situation.
No, you
what
haven't.
Is a safety device?
No, and actually, our statute doesn't call it a safety device. It calls it a safety appliance. That is the term that is used in 62-4-37, is the willful failure or refusal to use a safety appliance furnished by your employer. Now, there's no doubt here that safety, you know, it would be like saying you can't have more than one thing. I go back to what Justice Zinter said at the very beginning. This is a hazardous chemical. Mr. Holscher doesn't dispute that it was to prevent a spill, nor does he really dispute that it was for the safety of the employees, because what is the first thing he did? The most telling evidence, in my opinion, is the first thing that Mr. Holscher did when he found out the spill occurred. He did exactly what Mr. Freeman says the purpose of the rule is meant to prevent. He tried to get that to go down the drain. If the purpose was to prevent environmental spills, why would the first thing you do be to try to get it to go down the drain? What happened was the first thing that he did, and the reason that he did that was because he said, why did you do that? I was worried about the safety of the fellow employees. How about the safety of yourself? Were you concerned about that at all? Yes. So he creates the condition that the device was meant to prevent, and his first concern is with the safety of himself and his fellow employees.
Let me go a little step further on this. Does this open up, then, more issues in workers' comp? For instance, in this case, as I read the case, I couldn't quite understand exactly, but part of the injuries were caused because he couldn't figure out how to get this gas mask to work and had to... and there wasn't a gas mask right there, and somebody had to go get it for him, and he put it on and couldn't get the tanks in correctly, and it wasn't working. Now then, does that open up some kind of a defense that should be then that should be presented, and in fact then it becomes what actually caused his injuries, and that his injuries could have been prevented if that gas mask would have been working appropriately, or if they'd have been, you know, had more safety devices in that regard. I'm just saying, what does this all open up now?
I think it opens up exactly what the statute says, and that is if you as an employer take the actions that the statutes require and other statutes require as well, safety posters. Safety is a key element in workers' compensation, both for even getting insurance as well as a requirement that you post safety. Everybody is very concerned about safety. And when you have an employer who takes the actions to train, to institute and utilize appliances that will prevent spills that can cause injury, and they do all of that, and the person willfully disregards it, that unfortunately, regardless of the seriousness of their injury, they are barred from receiving workers' compensation benefits. It's no different than Mr. Driscoll drinking and driving his car, and all of a sudden he runs into some ice and snow, and he runs into an S-curve, and he hits a bridge. That goes to the issue of proximate cause. That remains an element of the willful misconduct defense, is that the employer must prove proximate cause. Now, proximate cause, we all know, doesn't have to be the only cause. It has to be, it can have several contributing causes. It doesn't even have to be the last or the nearest cause. If it concurs with other causes acting at the same time and causes the injury, then there's proximate cause. And I think that goes to your issue, Justice Meyer-Henry. In this case, without that acid spill, was it a substantial factor in causing this injury? And I don't know how you can get there under the facts of this case that was not a substantial factor. And once it is, then the burden has been proven. And yes, it is a very tough remedy, just as it was for the widow of Mrs. Thirkelson, who stood up here before this court and wanted to get death benefits for her husband when he drank before he got behind the wheel of an automobile. And just like it was for Mr. Goble. Sometimes these cases have severe results, but this is what the court said in Gold. An employee cannot recover because of his own willful misconduct when there is substantial evidence to support the conclusion that in that case the use of a drug, and in this case the disengaging of a dead man's valve in order to prevent the chemical spill of acid, was a substantial factor in causing an unfortunate accident. No doubt this was unfortunate. But the point is, the statute has to mean something. And if you take it all away, then it doesn't mean anything. And what we have here, I believe, is evidence to support that safety of the employee was a purpose of this particular device and of the rule not to lock it open. Now, what does Phillips say? I think Phillips gives a little guidance on that, on the safety aspect, when it says the examples that are given in SDCL 62-4-37, such as intoxication, willful failure to use a safety appliance. The court said was that the violation of any one of those conceivably increases the probability of injury. And here we have a situation that undoubtedly increases the probability of injury. Now, you got to remember, at the time that Mr. Holscher did this act, he was well aware of the plug in the drain. This wasn't a surprise to him. This wasn't something that he knew. He was the supervisor. He knew that when he left this room this time on this day, and this is in the record, and this overflowed, it was going to stay in that room because the plug was there. He knew that. He also knew that in the room were those other chemicals that, if mixed with that acid, would form the mustard gas. In fact, he testified that he knew by leaving the room after he had propped open that gal, the probability of a spill had gone up because nobody was going to be there to watch that. So he knew, just as what was required in Phillips, that the probability of injury, the probability of a spill, was increased by his actions. So we do have guidance from this court. I don't think that in addition to simply having the safety appliance, there are really two ways to prove misconduct. Other is just to prove willful misconduct. The first part of the statute says the employee engaged in willful misconduct, including self-inflicted injury. Fenner, for example, was willful misconduct. That was a case where he simply disregarded the advice of his doctor and went back to work and hurt himself. So there is something separate and apart from the safety appliance. And that would be willful misconduct in disregarding a rule that is enforced by the employer in order to make this a safe workplace for the employees. You know, I think it's interesting that the Georgia case, Herman, that was cited for you, sometimes there are employments that are just inherently dangerous. And this is one of those. It's inherently dangerous to work with these types of chemicals. And the physical arrangements sometimes creates also the inherent and the increased safety. You can't remove those by his actions. Those safety things are simply there inherently by the nature. Now again, the only state of the few that have the willful misconduct that talk about it being primary is Louisiana. But I think it's very, very important to recognize that the reason that the court didn't allow that in Louisiana is that it stated, if the court was to adopt the theory that was being pronounced there by the employer, what would happen would be that it would be allowed to defeat recovery because of the gross negligence on the part of the employee, or in this case, the intentional disobedience of instructions, which was not the law in Louisiana. But it is the law in South Dakota. It is the law in South Dakota, as most recently stated by this court, once again in Molden versus Hills Material, a 2005 case that I don't believe was cited in the brief. And that is, once again, to reiterate the definition of willful misconduct, something more than ordinary negligence, but less than deliberate or intentional conduct, gross, willful, wanton, or reckless conduct. So the one state that the appellant relies upon says they didn't adopt that rule because it would have allowed to defeat recovery for gross negligence. So it's difficult to look at a state and say we must have this primary purpose rule when that state says it's adopting that in order to reach a conclusion that would not be the law in South Dakota. So Louisiana...
Let me ask you, though, about the status of the law in South Dakota. You know, Phillips and Trimac and Mullen involved willful misconduct, and that our statute's written disjunctively, with willful misconduct leading off and then there being or willful failure to use a safety appliance. So do those cases, the principles in those cases on willful misconduct necessarily apply to the refusal to use a safety appliance?
I would argue, Your Honor, that both apply. that perhaps this, not only do we have this appliance, but the fact that we created the rule, the fact that we went one step further, which was being followed in this case, that being that supervisors only dispensed this chemical because we wanted to put it in the hands of our most trusted employees to perform this most hazardous act, that when you start looking at the rule aspect here and not just the safety appliance is when you go back to the standard of willful misconduct. That if you're going to look at rules that have and are applied across the board, and if you look at Virginia, I believe, as cited in the brief, the reasonable rule is that the rule is reasonable, that it's enforced. It's very similar, but it's different. And Larson, too, makes the distinction between willful misconduct and the violation of the of a safety appliance. And it says that deliberate defiance of a reasonable rule laid down for safety will be held to constitute willful misconduct. So when you're talking about the rule, do not lock valve open in the enforcement of that rule, you could look at it under the willful misconduct aspect of the South Dakota definition, and then you also have, in this case, in our opinion, the violation and the willful refusal to use a safety appliance. So both of them are applicable here.
Do you agree that the Larson test, I'm sorry, I guess your time's up, but do you agree that the Larson test that was established here, the 1-2-3-4 test on the questions that need to be asked, is the appropriate test to use?
Yes, I do. And my time is up, and thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Freeman, you have 10 minutes.
One of the things that council stated was that Louisiana is the only state that says that safety has to be a primary purpose. It is true that there's very few states that have this type of law in place, and this issue doesn't come up very often. But there are other states that have talked about what this safety rule is. And what is a safety rule or a safety device or a safety appliance. And the courts, with the exception of Georgia, seem to universally talk about the fact that this rule has to have been adopted and put in place in order to protect an employee. That's the purpose of the rule. Now, they don't say whether it's the primary purpose, all of them, and they don't say whether it's the only purpose. Or what they talk about is that the law or the rule had to be laid down for the benefit of the worker to avoid some known danger. And then they go on to talk about the fact that this worker then has to know of this danger. And it has to be actual knowledge, not constructive knowledge. So to state that Louisiana is the only one who comes up with this cockamamie idea that there has to be more than just some connection to safety isn't true. If you look at this volume of cases that we've both presented to you, that does seem to be a theme that's running through those cases. The council also argued that Mr. Holscher doesn't really dispute that the purpose of the valve was for safety, because when asked what his concern was, he said he was worried about the safety of others and his own safety. Well, you have to look at that statement and when it was made, and we're talking about foreseeability, and then we're talking about here's a guy standing around with this, if you look at the record, it's a purple haze that's getting bigger and bigger into a room, and he runs in and he's trying to open up this drain. Well, what is his concern at that point? He has gone through training and he knows that there's, if acid and chlorine mix, that it's going to create a mustard gas that could be deadly. He knows that. And he sees it forming. Well, anybody in their right mind at that point in time is going to be primarily concerned about everybody's safety. And he also goes in and realizes that the employer hadn't set up any system, any way to actually clean up this mess if it should possibly occur. The employer probably didn't foresee this ever happening.
What about the pumps? I thought they had a system to pump it out.
Well, they didn't really have a system to pump it out. What the testimony is that he got a maintenance guy who ran to some other part of the building to get a pump, and the pumps didn't work, and they tried to pump it out. The way that the chemical actually got out of there is Holscher jammed this drain down the plug because they couldn't pump it out. But that was the method that was supposed to be used, is to use some pump that wasn't readily available. There's no respirators right there. You know, chemical spills have occurred at the plant before, but there didn't seem to be any way to clean it up if such a thing did occur. So as far as whether or not such an incident was foreseeable, I don't think that it was foreseeable either from Holscher or from the employer's standpoint. And the fact that there was no means of cleanup and no respirators available, respirators that would be used for this type of gas, is indicative of that. The standard that we're espousing here today to be adopted in looking at these cases is a standard of willfulness in disengaging a known safety device. And this has to be something where safety is a primary purpose. The rule is imposed to protect somebody from this type of accident.
That's the only thing that can save your client, isn't it, in this case? Because beyond that, he doesn't meet any of the tests. I mean, he willfully did prop this thing open.
Well, I don't know that he willfully did. I think he knowingly performed an act, but whether it was...
Well, then he went to lunch or the lunchroom.
Well, he didn't.
He didn't stay there. And
he didn't go out to lunch. He was still furthering the employer's purpose and working. But... What we are espousing is, I think, a reasonable rule, whether it saves my client or not. I think that in putting this broad Georgia standard, saying anything that has any relation to safety, if you violate it, you're out of luck, really doesn't further the purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act and the idea behind 62437. The willful refusal to use such a safety appliance or device does require a knowledge of the danger that the person is engaging in. And I think that something we can all agree on is, you know, I mentioned the safety on a saw as being, you know, that would certainly be dangerous. And in looking at that, when somebody disengages that safety and puts their hands into a machine, or some of these other cases where, you know, there's conveyor belts going and you don't put a lockout on it, and you stick your hand into a thing or you know what you're getting into.
Well, but in light of the training that your client had, isn't this the same situation? I mean, this was extraordinary training from the cases we usually see.
Well, I think that the training was a knowledge of the chemicals, and I think that Holscher did have a knowledge of the chemicals. But to know or foresee that this chain of events would occur, I think, is not as immediate and as apparent as sticking your hand into a machine. And, in fact, many spills have occurred before without injury. Now, counsel in their brief does mention, well, you know, the fact that we've had other spills without incident shouldn't be held against us. Keep in mind, we're not saying the fact that no injuries occurred before was bad. We think that's good. The fact that no injuries had occurred before with chemical spills or with overflowing of the acid goes more to whether or not sustaining an injury was a foreseeable or a probable event from the occurrence. So, I forgot the point I was making, but the fact that this hadn't occurred before, and yes, they're dealing with dangerous chemicals, and yes, he has had some training and knowledge of. You know, what happens with the chemicals. I think that in order for us to take the employer's responsibility off of this claim has to be something more than just, you know, having knowledge of the chemicals and you know, being told don't prop open the valve, I think that you need to have something more constructive. I don't think that Holscher's actions in this case arise to the level that that was intended to prohibit recovery when 62-4-37 was enacted, and ask that the court consider defining what a safety element is, and further defining what a willful refusal to use that would be.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess.